Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we cover a wide range of topics being overlooked, ignored, or outright censored by the corporate press. We'll begin with a discussion on public health effects of wireless technology, and we'll also hear from several authors and activists about their latest work on social justice themes in the community. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're going to be looking at safe technology concerns. We will be joined by numerous guests, and it is an honor and a pleasure for me to reintroduce my guest co-host for the day. That is Ken Burrows. Ken Burrows is a longtime contributor to Project Censored, member of the Media Freedom Foundation, and a professor who teaches holistic health at San Francisco State University. Ken Burrows, welcome back to the program. I'm delighted to have you co-hosting today.
Nice to be here, Mickey. And we have with us also Lloyd Morgan, who is an electronic engineer who spent 38 years in the high-tech industry until he developed a brain tumor and began to realize that something may be going on for him, that he's been spending a big part of his life now publishing and thinking about how to think differently about the nature of electromagnetic radiation and the issues affecting all of us.
And of course, we'll also have on momentarily several other guests, including Audrey Johnson, who's a biology student, who's a co-president of the Project Censored Club at San Francisco State University with you. And she has been researching the biosocial impacts of wireless technologies for her news stories and helping organize a campus teach-in that will be coming up called The Promises and Perils of Technology and Social Media. But Ken Burrows, why don't you get the conversation started with a bigger picture with Lloyd Morgan?
Mm-hmm. Lloyd, great to have you here.
Thank you.
And so you've been spending a lifetime, or at least your later life, looking at these issues around health, and you've published over 12 papers, I believe it is. And can you say more about your work and what really brought you to this?
Well, I'm an electronic engineer by training. In 1995, without knowing I had a problem whatsoever, I went to lunch with a work colleague and had a 45-minute grand mal brain seizure during the lunch. That turned out to be a tumor of the meninges, a lining of the brain, called a meningioma. And I spent 14 days totally in the hospital, 8 of them in critical condition. When I asked my neurosurgeon, why did I get this thing? He said, perhaps electromagnetic fields. I went immediately to the science. I found immediately, in those days it was electricity fields, that utilities actually were publishing papers showing significant risk for brain cancer, for leukemia, for other diseases.
Well, and since then you've been writing quite a bit. You have a number of studies associated with RF, or radio frequency radiation, especially since the 2011 findings of the International Agency on Research on Cancer, the findings of the WHO agency. Could you talk about your writings and what you've been bringing to the field?
Yes, I'd be glad to. IARC in 2011 declared that radio frequency radiation, mostly microwave radiation, is a possible human carcinogen. 2011 is quite some time ago, as things move very fast, and I have been looking at all the papers published since then that show all sorts of different kinds of risks for cancer studies. There's 14 brain cancer studies, there's 5 tumors of the meninges, 4 hearing nerve tumors, 4 salivary glands. These are papers now. 3 eye cancers, 2 breast cancers, 1 melanoma, 2 leukemia. And also, there are studies showing cancer incident rates increases for most of these cancers. The data is voluminous. The science is there. The ignoring of its existence is complete.
The science is there. Then why is the public not knowing about this?
Well, the public requires the media to tell them about it. But if you think about it, how much advertising does the media get from cell phones and other wireless devices? So it's in their interest not to publicize it because they lose advertising if they were.
Well, certainly the New York Times or some large paper you think would pick this up and do some kind of expose.
I am a regular reader of the New York Times. I admire it greatly. But on this issue, it has been terrible forever. And I recently learned the reason, and that is their single largest stockholder is Carlos Slim, who sometimes is the richest person in the world, and it keeps bouncing around, but he controls all of the telecom industry in Latin America.
So you're saying the vested interests basically are somehow muting the media?
Yes, though muting is an understatement.
Where is technology right now? Are the models improving? Are things enhanced? And what about Europe? What is Europe doing with these issues?
Europe and the United States are pretty much the same. The very interesting thing about Europe is in terms of the scanners used at airports, the one that we have to put your arms up in the air, they pretty much abandoned. Otherwise, it's very similar.
Well, and these new tech models, are they improving with, you would think, with technology enhancing? Are our health risks lessening with the new models that seem to be coming out?
Well, one of the things that I found very exciting is that between the what I call dumb phones, you can think of them as a second generation or 2G phones, their average radiated power is relatively high compared to the third generation smartphones, which is 1,000 times lower. However, a study showed that the risk per 100 hours of use of a smartphone is more than four times the risk of the same use on a dumb phone. Now, apparently the reason is, which they cite some papers, is that somehow the UMTS, that's the name of the modulation, inhibits DNA repair genes. So that could be the reason that we're seeing so much higher risk, but no one's going to begin to look at the modulation frequencies. All that happens is the new products just come into the marketplace, no pre-market safety testing. LTE, which is the fourth generation, I love the name, long-term evolution, hasn't been out in the market yet. It has been out for years to be able to study what the users of the fourth generation phones, what health effects there are on the users of fourth generation phones.
And yet the telecom industry is pretty much in denial of there being any safety impacts or any problem.
They insist that there is absolutely no health effects. Zero.
This is Mickey Huff. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. With guest co-host today is Ken Burrows. We're speaking with Lloyd Morgan. And today's program, we are looking at safe technology concerns. We're going to get into the 5G network, the Internet of Things, and certainly much more with other guests. But Lloyd Morgan, so while we're talking about telecom, of course, Project Censored has covered this issue before. Ken Burrows, you've certainly been researching this for a while, as you have Lloyd Morgan. We've had stories in the book, and naturally, we get a lot of pushback. We get a lot of disbelief. And of course, more pejoratively than that, we get people saying that it's a crackpot issue and it's a conspiracy theory and the telecom industry says it's all safe and so on. But that's actually not true either, because if you read the manuals for these devices, and I know in Berkeley, California, a couple years back, we actually did a show about this with you all, and the city council said, well, you have to label cell phones. And all they were doing was taking the warning that was already in two-point font in the manuals and just blowing it up and putting it on the box to tell people, like, hey, look, you're not supposed to put this on your body. And so lawyers got to team through all that stuff, right? So in order for them to have a liability warning like that in the label, that must mean that there's something going on.
Yes, the FCC even required them to produce these warnings. You know, cell phones as used today are dangerous. But if used differently, they don't have to be dangerous. We all know that cars are not safe, but they're safe enough. Cell phone use can become safe enough. If you keep it 6 inches from your head or your body when you're not using it, you get a 10,000-fold reduction in the amount of microwave radiation your brain or your body is absorbing. Industry can also do various things to change the design such that they become safe enough.
Well, thank you, Lloyd, and we invite your comments throughout the program. We also have a very extensive list of people with us today. We have a student, Audrey Johnson, who's been doing research on a series of news stories on this, which you want to hear from shortly. But also we're hosting on our campus a teach-in, as Mickey mentioned, on the promises and perils of technology and social media, which will be coming up. We hope that Lloyd and some of our other guests will be a part of that.
Today's program, Safe Technology Concerns, we've been speaking with Lloyd Morgan, and now we're joined by Audrey Johnson, who's a bio student and co-president of the Project Censored Club at San Francisco State University, where Ken Burrows works. So, Audrey Johnson, welcome to the program, and tell us about what you're working on.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad to be back on the program, and currently, along the lines of how do we use our technology safely? Me and a lot of other people are really concerned about this 5G wireless network. And it really has no safety testing at all. And we already know the implications that our cell phones can have on our bodies and our health. But this 5G wireless is a whole new game where they have to put these small cell antennas on buildings, which basically is going to be everywhere, and it's going to affect everyday life, everything from ecology to how much electro pollution is in our system, and even everything down to like small tissue cells like our mitochondria, which are tiny powerhouses. So everything's going to be really affected, and there's no testing at all. And we already know the implications of what our cell phones can do to our bodies, and it's just going to affect everything in life. Firefighters are already exempt from this SB 649 bill that's going to allow these telecom companies to put wherever they want these small cell antennas, which is just really terrible. And if the firefighters are saying we don't want it, it's affecting our health, what does that say for the rest of the people that need to be protected?
We're going to get into more about SB 649 with some of our other guests. But Audrey, while we have you on the phone, do you want to tell us a little bit more about the teach-in that you're all planning?
The teach-in is basically going to talk about how to use our technology safely, because not everybody knows that cell phones can damage sperm or can give you breast cancer. So it's basically going to open that door to a lot of the students here at San Francisco State about what can we do, like how can we use our phones safely at a safe distance. Also, what other solutions can there be besides just wireless? These fiber optics are a good solution instead of always having everything wireless. So it's just basically to inform other students about how we can use our technology safer.
And Ken Burrows, do you know anything about when the date this will be, or mm-hmm. where people listening might get information? Because this is going to be, of course, local to the Bay Area and San Francisco State University, but there may be chances for others to see stuff streaming, archived, et cetera.
Of course. We're hosting this event the first, perhaps the second week of November. We're looking at November 8th right now, but we have to get clearance from various campus organizations to host this. But we're certainly announcing it on our website, and we'll make it available for anyone that's interested.
Fantastic. And Audrey Johnson, we thank you for taking time out of your day.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll be hearing from two other guests. We'll be hearing from Ellen Marks, who's the founder and director of the California Brain Tumor Association. And we'll also hear from Raynette Sainam. We will be back after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with guest co-host Ken Burrows. And Ken, please introduce our next guest, Ellen Marks.
Ellen is founder and director of the California Brain Tumor Association. She's testified before the U.S. Congress on the health impacts of cell phones and has co-produced an award-winning documentary called Mobilize. She's been educating people on the truth behind the wireless radiation and the impact on health. And she's been involved lately with the California Alliance for Safer Technology to defeat Senate Bill 649. She's also really not an advocate against advanced technology. She really wants the just honesty from this industry and how do we find the safest ways to really deploy technology. Ellen, it's great to have you on the program. Welcome. And what do you
thank
have to share
you.
About 649? It's already passed, right?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It has passed the Assembly and the Senate a couple of weeks ago. We were fortunate that it did not pass with as many votes as we thought it would, so our lobbying efforts did pay off somewhat. It is ready for Governor Brown to either veto or sign, and we're hoping, obviously, for a veto. Should I explain what SB 649 is?
Yeah, because our listeners may not know that this is even happening at all, and that's why it's on as a topic of the show. And I've had people emailing about this topic to Project Censored for quite some time. And so, yeah, we definitely want people to get an idea, a bigger picture of what we're looking at.
SB 649 is basically a bill that was written by telecom, introduced by Senator Hueso of San Diego. And what it does is streamlines industry's ability to place wireless facilities wherever they want. And it takes away city and county authority. It takes away people's voices as to where this should be and where it shouldn't be. And all it really does is increase telecom's bottom line. They're making promises that it will close a digital divide, that areas, you know, rural areas and areas of high density, low income will get better connectivity, and there's nothing in the bill stating that. That is not going to happen. Knowing this industry, they will go to where they make the most money. So it's a terrible bill. It will put 5G equipment, which is, they call it small cells, it's not really small, they will be able to put this in every public rights of way in every community, which means that it will go on power poles, it'll go on light posts, it'll go on traffic signals, it'll go fake mailboxes. So it'll be right outside people's homes, probably about 20 feet from kids' bedrooms.
And schools.
And near schools, yes. And obviously, there's many opposed. There's 300 cities and 47 counties opposed to this. The California Department of Finance is opposed. Many, many people are opposed to this, the Teamsters Union. But I think our group, the California Alliance for Safer Technology, is probably one of the only groups speaking out about the health effects. It's being ignored. And the industry likes to say that there are no health effects. But then again, if you look at their information they give their shareholders, they admit that there's health effects from wireless radiation. So there's a big contradiction there. So not only does this take away local authority, but it also limits the revenue that cities can collect. It's limited to $250 per permit, and some of them charge $3,000 or $4,000 now, and that money goes to our schools, it goes to our road maintenance, libraries, things like that. So the cities will be losing revenue. Another thing is that the state is placing the liability, if anybody gets hurt or there's any kind of damage, fire damage, anything, on the cities, because telecom cannot get insurance. Lloyd's of London and other underwriters will not insure them from damage from radio frequency. So there's lots of negatives. And that last one about the insurance added insult to injury for the cities. So the five top mayors in California met with Governor Brown recently, and we've heard that there's a good chance it will be vetoed, and we certainly hope so. Mayor Sam Liccardo wrote an excellent editorial in the New York Times about this issue. And, you know, of course, he doesn't mention the health effects, you know, unfortunately, the elephant in the room. But he does talk about how this is not democratic and should not be happening.
Ellen, can you speak to what is the ultimate vision of the national and the international wireless industry then? What's really driving all this?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. Smart cities. They began this with smart meters. And now all of this infrastructure is meant to give us smart cities. But nobody's talking about a balance between health and smart cities. So telecom has trillions of dollars to make by doing this at the expense of our health and welfare.
And this is also part of the Internet of Things, is it not?
Right, exactly. That the Internet of Things and smart cities all goes together. And they're pretending that there's no harm from 24/7 microwave radiation, but there's a lot of science, which Lloyd Morgan can explain, showing that there is a great risk to our bodies and to the environment and wildlife from 24/7 exposure to this wireless infrastructure. So, yeah, it's really about cars that'll drive themselves, the Internet of Things, your phone talking to your refrigerator and things like that. Do we really need that? It's a very serious threat to our health, to our property values, and we really need to take this seriously, and we really need to consider the legislators who voted yes for this. It's known that our legislators in California were given about $25 million in the last election campaign from telecom. Legislators who voted yes, and we educated these legislators, we lobbied ourselves, we paid for lobbyists, and we told them that their constituents were being sold a bag of goods, that the industry was not being honest about this, closing the digital divide, etc., and they still voted for it. We need to seriously look at these people and decide if we want to reelect them next time.
You know, here in Berkeley,
this is Lloyd Morgan.
Senator Nancy Skinner voted in favor of this and is highly supportive of it. So come a new election, it would be interesting to see what happens.
And Ellie Marks, can you give the listeners a few places online where they can go and find out more about this information? You know, radio is great for skimming the surface and trying to help people think about these things in different ways. But where would you land people to find out more about the things you're discussing?
We have two websites. One is CA, the number 4, safertech.com. And the other is noon649.org. And they can get more information there. And one thing I'd like to point out also that's very important is the firefighters who have known for years that living in a fire station with a cell tower causes neurological damage and cancer have been given an exemption in this bill. So why are the firefighters getting an exemption, but our children and grandchildren are not?
So it's okay for schools, but not for firefighters' houses.
Exactly. So I hope people will visit the websites and consider this. I mean, sadly, we have a school right here in California, Ripon, California, that's had a cell tower on the grounds for 8 or 9 years, and there's several cancers at the school with young children. We can't do this. It's immoral, and it's definitely not democratic to take away the local authority and the voices of the people.
Ellen, thank you very much for being on and for all the good work that you do.
We're going to conclude our segment on safe technology concerns right now with our final guest, Ken Burrows. Please introduce
Renette Senham. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You bet. Great to have you here. Renette is a past mayor of Nevada City, also a city council member there now, and I believe also a past cell phone store owner. Am I correct?
Yes, that's very correct.
And also, you're a very active community activist in that region. So welcome, and what do you have to share with us about this very important issue?
SB 649 is a California bill that would ultimately allow telecom industry to come into the public right-of-way and be able to deploy what are called small cell antennas, which is a bit misleading because it's more than just small cells, but this is to be done without any local control, environmental impacts, very outdated standards, no guidelines, and also very little compensation to the cities. So myself and many others throughout the state of California have been fighting this SB 649, and it is currently on the desk of Governor Brown, and we are hoping that he is listening to the over 300 cities and 47 counties out of 58 in California are officially opposed to this bill.
We just had Ellen Marks on, and she overviewed this as well. What would you have to add as a city council member?
I became alerted to this through my city government, through the League of California Cities. And basically, this proposal is too far-reaching. And what it does is that it overrides our land use zones, including private property. It bars any public discussion or any kind of political local authority decision. And it ultimately creates a Pandora's box for California cities because not only does it blatantly strip local governments authority to protect the quality of life of their residents, but it actually sets a very, very dangerous precedent.
Well, what should we be doing as far as, again, the public? The same question I asked Ellen. So how do we respond to this? What do we do?
Well, no matter what happens with SB 649, whether it is signed into law or it is vetoed, this fight is not over. This is simply one battle, and people must understand that 5G technology is a 60-year-old technology. It has never been deployed like this on humanity before. And so no matter what happens to SB 649, every state throughout the United States must start demanding that we have a moratorium on 5G technology until we know more. And this is actually our responsibility. We know enough that we should be asking and demanding to enact a moratorium on 5G deployment throughout the communities until we know more.
Do you have any final thoughts?
Simply just keep your ears and eyes open for SB 649 and also keep your ears and eyes open in your own local jurisdictions for these type of laws and bills because they are extraordinarily dangerous.
Thank you, Renette. Best wishes there in Nevada City.
And certainly thank you, Ken Burrows. And Lloyd Morgan, any brief last words from you?
Just that what everybody's saying is true and important, and we need to deal with it. The telecom industry is so incredibly wealthy, multi-trillion dollars a year in revenues, that they're a hard opponent to challenge, but we can do it.
Well, Lloyd Morgan, thanks again for joining us on the Project Censored Show. Ken Burrows, again, thank you for putting together a wonderful line of guests on this very important and timely issue. And we'll obviously be taking this up again.
Great.
I'd like to thank all of our guests for this discussion on public health effects of wireless technology. Thanks to my guest co-host, Ken Burrows. Coming up next, Michael Levitin returns to the Project Censored Show. He's our correspondent and also an Occupy.com journalist. He recently sat down for a conversation with Eleanor Goldfield, founder and host of ACT OUT and author of Paradigm Lost. Stay with us for that interview.
Hello, this is Michael Levitin with Project Censored. Today we're interviewing Eleanor Goldfield. She's an activist, poet, journalist, and producer of the weekly news program ACT OUT, which airs every week on Wednesdays on Occupy.com and on Free Speech TV on the weekends. Eleanor is the founder of Art Killing Apathy. It's a group that uses creative means to bring about political progress. She's also the author of a new book, Paradigm Lost: Radical Verse and Visuals for the Shift. Eleanor, welcome to Project Censored.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eleanor comes out from Washington, D.C., and is recently touring with her book. She has been covering many issues across the country, most recently the disaster relief after hurricanes that have hit our numerous cities. So Eleanor, tell us a little bit about that coverage that you did.
Basically, I had on the show a community organizer who's an expert at disaster relief. He was with Katrina as well. His name's Bobby Rodrigo. And what he's basically done is he was in Texas, he was in Florida, and he's in Puerto Rico as well, organizing on the community level, working with or around government, as he says it, and getting people what they need. And basically what he said is that there's so much standing in the way. Like FEMA puts up so many blocks for people to actually help out. Red Cross was turning away doctors in Houston. And actually in Houston, there's this brilliant picture that I included on the show of a volunteer on an inflatable rubber ducky going out into the floodwaters to get people and to deliver supplies. That image in and of itself is such a powerful show of how people are working and getting stuff done without government aid.
More and more we are needing that, and then probably into the future, it looks like. So one of the slogans of your show, ACT OUT, is from tweets to marching in the streets. Mm-hmm. That has a lot embedded in it because it speaks to our online activism world and our need to get out of our rooms, out of our dorm rooms, out of our living rooms, our offices, and join the movements of today. You've been following this interaction between the digital space mm-hmm. and the activist space for a long time. Where do you see us in that process?
I'll quote one of my hacktivist friends who said that if you can't do the hacktivist work, then don't say that you do digital activism, because tweets and Facebook posts are great for drumming up support, for spreading information if you're working as a journalist in media, but that is not actually equivalent to going out into the streets and assisting on the ground. So from tweets to marching the streets, to me, is the idea that, well, we build awareness and engagement online. It's such a powerful tool, which is why fights like net neutrality are so important. I definitely don't want to discount the digital realm, but that is not where we change things. We change things by showing up. And showing up means everything from helping on a community level to helping on a national level. But it is showing up in the places and times that people need to show up.
So you don't just mean the protests. You don't mean as in marching, showing up, protesting, Trump protesting.
We have to do more than show up for the Women's March. This is not about showing up for one march and then patting yourself on the back. It means showing up consistently, and particularly showing up for the people who need the most help. It's about showing up at sit-ins, at blockades, disrupting meetings of oil companies. It's that kind of showing up. Permitted marches are another tool for raising awareness, but they don't actually change things.
And I think people are aware, given that the healthcare repeal movement of the Republicans crashed, plummeted, and imploded over these last months, mainly really due to public pressure in town halls and on their congress.
Yeah, people. And people, like in particular the disabled activists who did incredible work, literally being dragged from their wheelchairs protesting their loss of health care. So those images and those actions are incredibly powerful and things that people really need to engage in more.
Yeah. People tend to forget sometimes how important actually hitting the streets are. The last major time we saw that in America was in the Occupy movement when hundreds of cities were engaged in that way. But it seems that we go into remission and cycles in this country and really overall societies, and it will come back around again.
Yeah, Black Lives Matter is a good example as well. They do a lot of work with shutting things down and showing up in the streets.
So Black Lives Matter, racial justice, you just covered the Black Women March. Another movement, though, that seems to be obviously on everyone's radar who's paying attention remotely to our current circumstance, the planet, the climate movement. Mm-hmm. And you've covered that extensively. You have covered fracking protests, pipeline protests, coal trains and oil train protests, and the movements that are working to create more, obviously, renewable energy and sustainable communities. Where do you see right now, especially in the Trump climate-denying era, that movement going?
I think to take a line from Naomi Klein, who wrote This Changes Everything, that just one more picture of the polar bear is not doing it. We've seen so many images of destroyed planet and destroyed animals, and it's not really hitting us anymore. It's kind of like you get to the point where it doesn't affect you anymore. And so what I've seen is like the climate march, which was really a parade. That's what I tend to call permitted marches. It was a great celebration of planet, but it didn't do anything.
It was the precursor to the Paris Climate Accord. You mean the climate march several years ago?
That too, but I'm talking about more recently, the one in D.C. Over the summer. But yeah, I think in both cases, because even though the Paris Accord is important, the Paris Accord was not enough. It will not keep us from the 1.5 degree rise in temperatures. What we're really seeing, what I've been seeing on the ground at places that I've gone to on the front lines, is that these direct action camps, like the pipeline camps, like Low LRV camp in Louisiana that's combating the Bayou Bridge pipeline, Camp White Pine in Pennsylvania that's battling the Mariner East, these sort of camps that are literally putting themselves in the path of the pipelines, of course, like Standing Rock. The movements, these are the actions that are really going to make a change. It's the things that disrupt business as usual. We saw this in Germany as well. Ende Gelände blocked one of the biggest lignite coal mines in Germany, which still gets 40% of its energy from coal. They blocked their operations for several hours, 9 hours, I believe. So that's the kind of stuff that we need to be doing more of, because raising awareness on climate change, while it's important, it's getting to the point where we don't have the time to just throw up another picture of a polar bear, and it's not doing enough. What's doing enough is promising to people that you're going to show up and you're going to do what's necessary to block these dirty energy projects that are destroying people and planet.
So do you see young people, millennials, people who are really the ones who have the most future at stake, rising to this right now? Are they woke enough?
I guess you could say, who's ever woken up? But yeah, I think there's a lot of millennials. I mean, I'm 30 and there are lots of people that are younger than me even that are organizing on these direct actions and these blockades. But I think there's also a lot to learn from people that have come before. You know, the eco movement is not a new movement, and there's a lot we can learn from the people who've come before in terms of what we're up against, in terms of what we can expect from the state. So I think there's a lot of cross-generational working together, and I think that's very important.
And you brought up Europe. Tell us a little bit, because you take frequent trips, you go to Sweden and other parts of Europe. Make a few comparisons in terms of the protest movements and the youth movement. Obviously, Europe and America, there's parallel descents and ascents of our kind of more radical political culture in our moments. We had Occupy, but that was years ago. We have Black Lives Matter and we had Standing Rock. But in Europe, they've had real political parties that have arisen in Greece, in Spain, and in England now with Corbyn and his more radical labor movement. What are some examples that you see that maybe America could look to in Europe?
I think it's a connection to your radical past. I mean, most Americans, and I'm American and Swedish, I'm a dual citizen, but I think most Americans don't have a connection to a radical past, particularly white Americans, which I am. But in Europe, like I was in Paris recently and 150,000 people showed up for a march that's going against Macron's labor reform. 150,000 people. And the French, if you talk to them, they're like, no, we understand. understand revolution. This is what we do. When the government tries to do stuff that we don't like, we just show up and we know it. It's a part of their French identity. And I think a lot of Americans don't feel that they have that revolutionary or radical identity. And that's something that we really need to connect with. And that's why I think it's very important that we have these movements that are led by Black and Indigenous and people of color, because they have a stronger connection to a radical past than your average white American.
So it leaves us, gosh, I'm almost afraid to say, what do you think of hopes for 2018? Do you even see, I mean, there are many people of color, many young people, many women, many who look about the opposite of Trump and think about the opposite of Trump, mm-hmm. who are going to be running for office locally, city councils, county supervisors, state legislatures, and of course for Congress. Do you see a potential turning point? Because I know you're more on the active and resistant side than on the let's get political in the state houses, but isn't that the next step?
Well, I mean, I'm on the fight and build side of things because resistance is not really a stance, it's just an opposition. So I think it's important to have alternatives in mind, because if you just say I'm resisting, you're always on your heels. You're never actually building anything. You're not building alternatives. So I think I think you put it in the right level of importance, though. Your local politics are so much more important because you can do so much on a local level. I mean, a city council can decide that they're only going to use 100% renewable energy. That's not going to happen from the federal level at this point. So you can really make significant change on the local level. So people should really be engaging. And of course, the system makes sure that we don't hear as much about our local politics. So it's sort of by design, and yet we can do so much on the local level. So I definitely think that people should engage in their local politics. Whether you decide to engage on the federal level is a longer discussion, I suppose. But I do think that my friend, who's a former Black Panther, Kilo Nyasha, said that I'm glad Hillary didn't win, because I think a lot of people woke up that would have otherwise just gone back to sleep.
Better stay woke and mm-hmm. active. Very good. Thank you, Eleanor. Eleanor Goldfield, she has a new book out called Paradigm Lost, Radical Verse and Visuals for the Shift. It is a book that seeks to manufacture dissent through collaborative art and poetry. Thank you very much, Eleanor.
Thank you.
That was a pre-recorded interview with Michael Levitin, who was speaking with artist and activist Eleanor Goldfield. Up next on the Project Censored show, we hear a conversation with our associate co-hosts, Nolan Higdon, Nicholas Bayham III, and Desiree McSwain. They'll be talking about their recently published work in Censored 2018 on the new American authoritarianism, how the corporate media normalized racism in the 2016 election. Stay with us.
I'm pretty excited to talk about our chapter. For our listeners, Nick and I decided to write this chapter examining sort of the relationship between the corporate media and racism in Donald Trump's campaign, as well as his early months as president. I don't know how you feel, Nick, but I feel like our chapter has gotten more and more relevant with each passing week.
Yeah, I do too. I initially felt like, well, by the time it comes out, some of this will be dated and perhaps this will be sort of a discussion for the past. But I think that it's grown, frankly, in relevance as we move through the Trump administration.
Yeah, I noticed that I saw a report. It seems like I think this has been happening every year since 2009, at least, that the amount of reported hate crimes has increased every single year. So this is a trend that's definitely going in the wrong direction. And so I think having a discussion about what's fanning these flames of the already existing racism and hate in America is an interesting topic that I'm excited. And I hope our listeners will go out and get a copy of Censored 2018, which they can get it at projectcensored.org. So, Nick, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about sort of how we came up with this idea. We're talking about Jean-Paul Sartre and how we formulated this chapter.
So what we were mostly interested in here was the way that we saw the media, the mainstream corporate media, normalizing fascism. And for us, our focus was really, when we talk about fascism, was really on white ethno-nationalism. So we were concerned with the central racist components of fascism and how the media was covering it. And one of the things that I think we both felt was that the media was creating the false equivalencies, right? So that you would, on the one hand, have a what was frankly a white ethno-nationalist argument that would somehow be equated with a rational liberal democratic view. And I think both of us saw that this sort of puts racism on an equal level plane with a rational discussion about politics and ethics. And so Jean-Paul Sartre wrote about this, specifically with respect to anti-Semitism, and talked about how you, when you put the anti-Semite and the person who is not the anti-Semite, right, they just your regular average citizen who maybe has a left or a right or a centrist perspective, when you put those two together, the rational discussion of the person who was just a regular citizen trying to experience liberal democracy, their rationality can never win the day against the anti-Semitism, because the anti-Semite doesn't talk in terms of facts. There's nothing that can be disputed. It's passion. It's racist passion. It's, and if anything said, it's totally unsupported, etc. But that argument tends to win the day, because rationality has no, a rational argument has no hook against the anti-Semitic argument, because there's nothing rational there to grasp a hold of to dispute. And we started seeing that maybe this was also happening in our news media here, in debates between a rational thinker, by all accounts, and vehement white ethno-nationalism. And I think it also played out, by the way, in the Trump debates.
Yeah, and I think I've been very critical. This has to do with the field of journalism and the way students are taught how to be journalists and how journalists are respected. And it's just for listeners who don't know, typically in a journalism class, you're taught that you can do a story on someone, and if you're going to mention any group, you need to get quotes or something from that group so they can also be represented in the story, right? It's right. Supposedly being objective is all sides. But I think what's happened here now is that groups, particularly hate groups, have used that, knowing that journalists have to do that, and thus uses an opportunity to be a megaphone. And so the press operates as this megaphone where it gives more and more ground to these individuals and these groups. And they try and come up with new labels and names as a way. So, you know, they won't call them a racist. They won't call them a fascist. They'll call them an alt-right. And that way it becomes normalized, right? It's like, okay.
Normalized, yeah.
They're legitimate. They're on the political spectrum. Now we can talk about these alt-righters. But the field of journalism has a lot to do with that, this false equivalency. And I think journalists need to have that sort of moment that which you talk about there with Sartre, that two opposing sides do not both necessarily have two critical arguments that are grounded in fact.
Yeah. I mean, this is a problem in our society right now. We're forgetting, as a society, the distinction between hate speech and free speech. Hate speech is not free speech. How are we supposed to define what is hate speech? Does anybody have a clear definition of that? Desiree, for example, do you have a sense of what that actually means now in civil society?
In today's society, not really, because it seems like you can say anything, and as long as you're very passionate about it, then it's valid.
Right.
And I feel like we have this argument, and I feel like we've talked about this on two other shows at least. So it's interesting to see that it's an argument that we're having a new problem, but it's really not. I mean, the stuff that Trump's saying is, the presidents have been saying that forever. He's repeating it literally word for word, like, I'm the law and order candidate, or you know, if back in my day the police would have took them right out and knocked them on their butt or whatever. And it's just how you can't argue against that. Like you said, you can't argue against that blatant ignorance, where no matter how much facts you have or how peaceful you are in saying it or respectful or loving you're trying to get this other person to understand, it does not matter at all. They've made up their mind. They have the reality of what they're trying to make real. So there's no arguing with that. If you're logical or, you know, sensible in any way, they shut you out immediately.
Right.
I think that's a really critical point. I was, especially to our young listeners or social media users who engage in these online debates on social media, just stop. You know, if once the other party has no interest in facts, you're wasting your time and your energy that could be placed doing probably more productive good.
You can't win. And I think the other thing that's unfortunate about the news media sort of balancing these two things out is that not only can the rational voice not win, but the rational voice looks to be the loser, which then in a society that is full of sort of, you know, the sideshow mentality, right? Bread and circuses. In a society like that, most of the masses then look at the one who's winning the argument. I mean, this played out, in my opinion, in the debates. So you have one person who stands up and, okay, what is he saying in the debate? Crooked Hillary. That's what you get out of the debate. You get Crooked Hillary, Little Marco, Lion Ted, okay? And then Bush was just low energy, right? And then this is what you get out of the debate. So how am I supposed to debate that, right? And to actually come up with a policy proposal, like maybe I want to start talking about health care or whatever, or the thing that actually Hillary should have talked about and was about to talk about but didn't, which was a guaranteed minimum income, right? Didn't talk about that at all. But even that, as a rational proposal, how do you pose that against someone who's just spitting out the invectives? All Mexicans are bad. You're Crooked Hillary. I beat Lion Ted. You know, I mean, just where's the rational hook?
Today, being rational and being factual is seen as weakness.
Correct.
If you're not blatantly, if you're not like screaming with a vein popping out of your forehead and spitting all over the place with your tiki torch,
right,
then you, what you're saying doesn't matter.
Yeah, but this conversation we're having about the connection between media and Trump's brand of racism and hate, the chapter then talks about how that's elevated into authoritarianism because it normalizes it. It makes this side seem like a legitimate argument when they're known as the alt-right, and they engage in these television programs and news stories, et cetera. And the chapter kind of lays out this long history of the relationship between media and hate groups normalizing fascism. And some of the examples we talked about in the book, you talked about D.W. Griffith's film, A Birth of a Nation, where life imitated art. The Klan actually wasn't burning crosses prior to Birth of a Nation, but he did it in the film for dramatic effect. And then the Klan starts using the burning of crosses, and most recently the tiki torches. But we also saw other examples of that as well in the 1960s and 70s. We started to see a lot of this hate groups or racist groups start to move into media. We talked about William F. Buckley kind of normalizing what had happened in Chile with Pinochet's rule there. So there's sort of a long history of this taking place as a method, and our chapter lays that out. I guess one of the questions I would have for the panel here, though, is we said you can't maybe logically argue against it and win in an argument, you know, the old academic model of coming to conclusions. So then what do you do at that point?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing that you do is you reject a media that creates these equivalencies, period. We had to turn it off and not pay attention to it. I mean, they respond to their bottom line. We have to turn it off. And we have to insist on fact-based journalism. Now, I will say this. I think people are doing that. But I'm hopeful, always. I'm wondering whether the emergence of the Rachel Maddow show on MSNBC, which has its own faults, right? But I'm wondering if the emergence of that is an indicator of our desire to have fact-based journalism. Because one of the things I do respect about her program is that there are some facts in there that I can hang on to. And she will preface most of her arguments with some kind of historical analysis. Now, is it as deep as I would love for her to go? No. But it provides way more context, I think, than what most people are getting when they watch mainstream cable news.
Yeah, I think that's a critical point that I want to also clarify, that this turning off of media, I think that message is interpreted incorrectly often. And I'm glad that you added the fact-based notion to it. Often, I think people hear that message and their solution is to turn off all journalism and not trust any journalists. And I think this is how authoritarianism regimes roll, right? They've done this to educational institutions too. Right, you point out some teachers were ineffective or problematic, and thus you throw out all teachers. You do this with journalists, you do this with politicians, and then you end up with a population that no longer trusts any of its institutions, and it takes faith in someone like Trump or a political party.
Yeah.
So, yes, seeking out, I would sort of flip the narrative there and say seeking out fact-based journalists is almost more critical than necessarily just turning off
the
media.
I also agree. I think for me, I can probably be safe to say that if anything is like mass produced, mass media or anything like that, I'm pretty much going to ignore it. Or like you said, those key terms, like, I mean, although these candidates or Trump or, you know, his supporters are repeating things that have been said, I feel like this is one of the first times that we've had these terms that are used so widely and, you know, just constantly that, again, it's normalized. But on a day-to-day basis, how do you deal with that? I mean, I can turn off the TV or I cannot watch CNN, you know, for the next 10 years, and that's fine. But if I'm here in a real argument walking down the street, or God forbid I choose to go to a Berkeley rally or something like that, what can you really do or what can you really say? So I feel like a part of it is not, or leaving those days of true debates. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows how to debate anymore. There's no emphasis on that. It's all emotional.
And I think, you know, so, you know, what's happened here, I think, as of 2016, and certainly I agree with Nolan that it's been building for some time, is that obviously fact-based journalism has been replaced by the stuff that Sartre was referring to, right, that gets normalized. The rational campaign that lays out objectives and goals and so forth and so on has been replaced by marketing. Because if nothing else, well, Trump is certainly a failed business person. He is decent at marketing himself as otherwise. And, you know, he used reality TV to the greatest extent. His whole campaign is about marketing. In fact, his whole presidency is about marketing because he continues with this. So now Kim Jong-un is Rocket Man. But that's also why it's powerful as a branding tool, right? Now, will it get you any policy? No, probably not, right? But it will fire up the base because he's continuing to market. That's what this is. It's not a presidency. This is... we're going to have four painful years of blatant marketing.
You know, well, I think the marketing, yeah, is a way of getting the voters or enough of the majority to either be behind him or so divided they can't stop him. But you're looking like Wall Street. We got to remember Wall Street's hitting like record numbers while we're having this conversation.
Right.
So the 1%, as it were, are profiting immensely from the Trump administration.
Right.
And his supporters are arguing with, you know, a divided so-called left that are these Hillary supporters, Bernie supporters, too radical to support either group, that are fighting against one another.
Right. This is where the standard definition of fascism comes in, right? So this union between corporate business and your government. And frankly, we all should be smart enough to know that racism is the meat that gets dangled in front of us to divide us so that the 1% or whatever can, the so-called 1%, can gain the profits that they need to gain. And there, and this will be a massive boondoggle. These 4 years will be a massive boondoggle. Anything they do to health care, anything they do to the discretionary budget, it'll be a massive boondoggle to the wealthy, the whatever tax proposal they come up with.
I think it's like important to say, too, because you mentioned this about the bottom line, mass media cutting them off and they'll really be affected by it. I think with the NFL boycott, if you hear about it, if you're partaking in it, a lot of people are like, what is my little boycott going to do? You know, people watch NFL all over the world. Well, whatever small portion that has stopped watching has initially affected them. They've had like slides in ratings, which I think are equivalent to at least 200 million in just like the first opening week, which it seems nothing to like the $1 billion that it generates, but it is something because you thought that you couldn't affect it. And that's just a small portion of people, whether you support Kaepernick or not, you know? So if you continue that, or if we do that on a mass media scale, because I think a bigger portion of people can agree that they are unhappy with media, unhappy with journalism and where it is now, we can affect that.
I agree. Now, you know what, Nolan, if you didn't have another question, I want to ask a question of the panel here. Is this, can we apply this article that we've written here to things that are going on or have just gone on recently? Like, for example, does this article also in substance apply to an understanding of Charlottesville and the way that not just that the president said many sides, but that there are false equivalencies being drawn between, say, for example, Black Lives Matter and Antifa, or Black Lives Matter and white nationalists?
Yeah, I would agree, and I want to make sure we say something on air to clarify this too, which is that the statements we're making about some of these Trump supporters we're discussing, there is actually data to support that these individuals are voting for things like that are against their interests, but also against things they don't believe. So Thomas Frank, in his famous book What's the Matter with Kansas, sort of made this argument that there's these things that these white voters in the Midwest need, but they vote against them. Determining what someone needs can be debatable, but Arlie Russell Hochschild, in her book Strangers in Their Own Land, she discusses this great paradox, which is where she did a study of people in Louisiana in 2016, and she said that these individuals have certain things they agree on, they believe in, but then they vote against. And I'm bringing this up because I think this really shows Trump's ability and politicians' ability and the media's influence and how you can get people to vote against things they otherwise don't believe. And it becomes difficult to kind of convince them that they're doing something they don't believe. And she talks about environmentalism and sort of family values and small businesses, all these things they claim to believe in, but then they vote for people who are opposed to those.
That was a pre-recorded interview with Nolan Higdon and Nicholas Baham III. They were discussing their latest chapter in Censored 2018, The New American Authoritarianism, How the Corporate Media Normalized Racism in the 2016 Election. To hear the remainder of their discussion and other podcasts from Project Censored that you don't hear on air, go to projectcensored.org/radio, and please check out our Patreon account.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm executive producer and host Mickey Huff, along with Peter Phillips. Anthony Fest is our senior producer, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. Our associate co-hosts are Nolan Higdon, Nicholas Baham III, and Desiree McSwain, with intern Amy Casey. The Project Censored Show airs on 40 stations around the U.S. from Maui to New York. To learn more about Project Censored and our show, go to projectcensored.org, follow and like us on Facebook and Twitter. You can support our efforts at patreon.com/projectcensored. We'll see you next time.
Habitualized, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks of all the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times when the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love, we flip our brothers and our sisters. The kind of